Welcome to The Secret Life of Cookies, where we try to solve the world's problems through the miracle of carbohydrates, one recipe at a time, with host Marissa Rothkopf and her dog, Bosco.
Hello, and welcome to The Secret Life of Cookies. My guest, that's right, two of them, are Major Garrett, CBS News Chief White House Correspondent, and David Becker of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Together, they've written a must-read book called The Big Truth, which is part warning and also part guide to saving democracy. Nothing big, you know, just saving democracy. But it's a great book, and I hope you'll join us for the discussion. We are also, on occasion, joined by Bosco, my dog, and David's two dogs, Kramer and Elaine. It's a very special episode, and I hope you enjoy. If you'd like and are able to contribute to keep this podcast afloat in butter, please become a paid member of my Substack newsletter at marissarodkopf.substack.com, and also please consider becoming a member of the Deep State Radio Network for access to loads of extra interviews.
Welcome to The Secret Life of Cookies. We have not one but two guests today. We have Major Garrett, the CBS News Chief White House Correspondent, and his partner in writing crime, David Becker, who has nothing to do with crime, and the head of the Nonpartisan Center for Election Innovation and Research. I'm always trying to find some sort of acronym for that, but I can't, so we'll just
continue. CIR, and that works.
Okay.
We're at electioninnovation.org, if anyone wants to check it out.
Fantastic. And you should. And the other thing to check out is the new book that you have with you here on the counter in David Becker's kitchen, which is making its television debut, or actually its podcast debut. And you have written a book together called The Big Truth, Upholding Democracy in the Age of the Big Lie. And speaking of the big lie and the big truth, we will be doing something that is a great truth in the world of cocktails as we start out this beautiful sunny fall morning. How better than to steady our nerves and to drink one of my favorite cocktails, although we already have started out with some differences. What cocktail have you brought to us this morning?
So we're going to make old fashions, one of my favorites. You know, in this day of challenges to democracy, people who run elections are the people we've kind of highlighted in the book, the election administrators who are such heroes in 2020 and afterwards and facilitate our democracy. They often need to come home and take the edge off, usually not at 9 a.m.
No.
But we're going to make my favorite cocktail, an old fashioned with, and there are multiple ways. I prefer it with rye whiskey, but some people prefer it with bourbon, as you might, Marissa. And hopefully this will be something that people can look at after the sun sets and make themselves.
Yes, I will make this cocktail along with you, but I may taste it and then set it aside until it's sunset somewhere, which, considering the time zone thing, it's got to be sunset somewhere. Isn't that what they say? So why don't you take us through this? My co-host on this show is my dog Bosco, and I traditionally like to have a bone for him to chew while we're doing this, but instead all 80 pounds of him is standing at the door panting to attack a squirrel. So I'm going to open the door for him while you guys...
Patrick, my two dogs, Kramer and Elaine, are also here, and Kramer is chewing a bone himself. So
very good.
Kramer and Elaine, yes, from a famous TV show.
I got to keep up with this. Does Kramer have the personality of Kramer is my question. And is Elaine always asking questions?
Kramer has the most personality of any dog I've ever had. But it's his own unique personality.
Like Kramer.
Like, just like Kramer. What's Elaine like?
Elaine is beautiful. Not like Elaine from the time, though. She is quiet, and except for occasional bursts of yappiness.
And actually can dance.
it's so much different, and eats frozen yogurt without worrying about it, yeah. I'm sure. Which... for anybody who grew up in New York City in the 90s, eating that frozen yogurt, that was a very poignant episode for us. So talk us through the old fashioned, and then I want to get into, the topic of democracy in America.
That'd be great. Yeah. The way I make it is very simple. One thing I think that the big dispute is whether you should put muddled fruit in it or not. The answer to that is no, you should not put muddled fruit in it. That makes it sweet and goopy and messy. So it basically has three ingredients in it. First, bitters. The classic is Angostura bitters.
Right.
Put a couple of dashes in there like that, in a glass like that.
And it's worth noting that our country's founding has something to do with spirits. Many of the revolutionaries, as they plotted their ideas about how to challenge the British Empire, did so in public houses, did so in places where people drank. And one of the earliest conflicts of the Washington administration was over the taxation of distilled beverages, the Whiskey Rebellion. So distilled spirits, beer, anything like that is sort of synonymous and walked along the origins of our country, the formative experiences we had with democracy. So it is consistent, at least, to have this and our book right next to it.
And especially, election officials, if you read the book, you'll find election officials have truly been through a lot. They've been through threats and abuse and harassment over the last couple of years, not because they failed in any way, but actually because they succeeded in facilitating democracy with the highest turnout ever in the middle of a global pandemic. And unfortunately, the losing candidate has been spreading lies about this. Is one of the things we're
and their nerves
about.
Are rattled unnecessarily. And if this in any way can help calm those rattled nerves, we're all for it.
I have old fashions with
this book offers up a lot of worries about the future of democracy, but I also do believe that it has this very warm heart to it. And that is, and I want to get onto the topic of it a little bit later, but about poll workers and what election officials have done for this country. Because like any good story, I'd like to start out by scaring people or making them a little concerned. But let's finish. Let's pour a drink first.
The next important ingredient, second ingredient, is simple syrup. This I made myself. It is with turbinado sugar.
It's a beautiful dark brown.
It is really lovely. The color is wonderful. Compliments the whiskey. And I should also say, it's incredibly easy to make simple syrup. This is the first batch I ever made. I got it right the first try. No one can screw it up. One part sugar, one part water. Put it on the stove for a little bit. Let it cool. Put it in a container like this, and you've got it.
I think it's the name simple.
Yes, exactly. And it's very important to have a key aspect of the old-fashioned is also the tactile sensation of having the heavy crystal old-fashioned glass.
Absolutely.
Really nice. So you put just a little squirt of simple syrup in there. And then you take your whiskey, rye or bourbon, if you like. As I said, I prefer rye. One of my favorites right now is this one, Sagamore Rye. It's actually here. I live in Maryland. It's from Maryland. It's very good. Don't waste your money on like really expensive rye for a cocktail. You need for like a $75 rye. Anything in the $20 to $40 range is just fine.
It was good enough for our forebears. So there you go.
Exactly. So about, say, half an inch of whiskey in here.
Half an inch of whiskey. Okay.
Roughly. Depending on the night, it can be 3/4 of an inch.
And depending how well you measure, too. Can you give us that in metrics?
Yeah. No one's going to quibble about a heavy pour.
Right.
No one's going to quibble. No.
The next key are the big ice cubes.
You have the big ice cubes. Okay.
Yeah, big ice cubes are key. They melt at a very nice rate. You can get these, from Amazon or any home store. Really easy silicone.
So you've gone for the square ones, not the round orb-like ones.
I prefer the square. I think they clink a little better in the glass, but the round orb ones are also nice. They just kind of, they swish around a little bit. So that is a matter of personal taste.
And we're both basically squares. Anyway.
Having sort of a largish nose, I find the round ones, my nose gets in the way of the round one. So that's
you see my profile. I also blessed with the same proboscis. So I know exactly what you mean. And then this is actually key. I don't put an orange peel in there because actually I don't just have oranges sitting around all day long that I can. It's nice if you have that. But actually, I think something that's really nice as a treat. These are Luxardo cherries from Italy. They're the original maraschino cherries. They're not cheap.
But they're worth it. They're above and beyond. If you haven't, ask for them for Christmas.
Deep syrup. When you take a cherry out, maybe just a touch of syrup too, because the syrup kind of adds a little bit of sweetness to it.
Notice they're not bright red like the other ones.
So these are, that's what they look like if you can see them.
It's a real, it's exactly how you would imagine a deep, dark, ripe cherry. Right. And for the viewers at the listeners at home who don't have the pleasure of viewing this, you, David, have one of those absolutely beautiful long spoons, the really bartender worthy.
You got to have the long spoons. I mean, if you're going to, you know, especially during COVID, I don't know if other people did this, we weren't going out to bars. So I tried to make sure my home bar was up to snuff, and that's it. That's the old fashioned major.
Thank you.
Cheers.
We'll take a little sip.
Just a little sip. Cheers. I don't think I've ever done this before.
Maybe more.
Very nice.
Wow. Maybe I should be cautious about the taste, liking the taste so early in the morning, but there you go.
The old fashioned is very smooth, isn't it? And it's got a little sweetness to it. You can adjust the sweetness to how much you like. I like the rye better because it's a little less sweet.
Exactly.
It has a little more of a sugary edge to it, but they're both good.
I'm tempted to say breakfast champion, but I probably won't.
I also had comments about the Breakfast of Champions and then thought, probably shouldn't say that. But now that we've both said it, mine is a slight alteration on yours, and then we'll get straight into the book. Because I was using bourbon and not rye, I did it in the really old-fashioned way, which was putting sugar cubes in. Nobody has sugar cubes anymore. I literally am using the sugar cubes from my mother's house. It's like an homage to my mother. And I poured the bitters over it.
That's actually, I've seen that done before, and it's nice. It's just, it might take a little bit longer because you let the bitters kind of dissolve the sugar cube a little bit, and the sugar naturally dissolves. What I like with the simple syrup, you have a little more control over how much you put in.
Right.
But they're both acceptable. The only thing I urge against is the old kind of Don Draper from Mad Men muddled fruit in there. That gets, it just becomes kind of a mess.
And muddled fruit has no place in it. It's a strange Don Draper sort of creation. That's all I have to say. Historically speaking, I don't know where he came from it. So now that we have the nerve-steadying drinks near us, your book talks about, I think it's a book at once eye-opening and full of warnings, but also, as I said, it has this warm heart, there is hope in there. But you do sort of drop us in the middle of the midterm elections in it and talk about them being a bellwether because we are here standing on the brink of losing democracy. Boy, that's really a change from cocktails. But yeah. And the phrase you use, and this phrase has stuck with me, is the combustibles are before us as we face this midterm. Major, what do you mean by that?
What we mean by that is we have a certain number of Americans, I don't know the exact number, but it's in the millions, who look at the 2020 election and believe something was fundamentally wrong with it, approaching a crime, that something so dastardly happened that not only do they not believe the results of that election, which they should, because the results are credible, verified, and scrutinized more than any election in the history of our country, but they still don't want to. So there's a stubbornness about their belief that something was wrong. And that is transferring to the future election. And there are more and more Americans now, and this is primarily a problem in the Republican Party for the moment, who are prepared to challenge results in this upcoming midterm elections if they're dissatisfied with the results. And that creates a climate in which those who are already pre-dissatisfied or prepared to be dissatisfied could engage in behaviors or conduct that could make the voting process in the midterm elections more chaotic, more confusing, more combustible than it needs to be. That is to say, in polling locations around the country, there could be people who are afraid of fraud. There's no evidence that there is any there, but they're afraid of it. And they cause controversies in one place. That becomes a video sensation locally. But then as things do, they transfer to another place. And that becomes a video sensation nationally, which presents opportunities or incentivizes the same kind of conduct elsewhere. And you have a domino effect across the country. And election officials are very deeply worried about this. The idea that our election, which they're trying to manage and provide in a safe and secure way, can be mangled just by anxiety and the expression of that anxiety in polling places. Mm-hmm. Those are combustible forces, and they could run in all sorts of unpredictable directions, violent and otherwise.
Right.
They need not exist. They don't have to be there. We have the best election system we've ever had in our country.
Right.
We'll go into great detail about this. More ways to verify, more ways to authenticate, more ways to scrutinize. Mm-hmm. Our elections are really, really good. That goodness of the election doesn't mean in democracy you have to be satisfied with the results. You're entitled to be dissatisfied. What you're not entitled to do is slander the system, undermine the system, and attack the system just because you're displeased.
Let's take a little step back and talk about how safe our system is. Just let's create the baseline there.
The meat of the book is, we hope, somewhat uplifting and confidence building. The facts are that we've never held an election as secure as the November 2020 election was. We've never had an election that was as transparent, that had the kind of verified integrity that we've seen. We had more verifiable paper ballots in 2020 than ever before. Verifiable paper ballots are important. In the past, we have used more electronic voting machines that did not create a record that the human being who voted could look at, and we could go back to and recount and audit. 95% of all voters cast ballots on verifiable paper in 2020, including all of the voters in all of the battleground states. Every single one of the battleground states had paper. Georgia, North Carolina, Virginia, Pennsylvania all had paper statewide for the first time in decades. That was really, really important.
Meaning they didn't have them in 2016.
Right. And then those paper ballots were audited, probably most famously in Georgia, where they counted the presidential ballots three times, three different ways, all 5 million plus of them, including once entirely by hand to confirm the result was accurate. And it was. And then I think really importantly, Major and I talk about this in the book, we have to understand that there were some rule changes, some changes in process related to the pandemic that were natural, that we needed in order to navigate the highest turnout in American history while we were all scared. We didn't have vaccines then. We didn't know what to expect. We didn't even know as much as we know now about transmission. So there were some things to make mail voting a little bit easier, to make early voting a little easier, things like early voting in stadiums, things like that. Those rules were all set transparently and in the public months before the election. Mm-hmm. In many cases, the campaigns litigated those rules in court. The rule of law presided over that. We knew what the rules were. When we closed the polls on election day in 2020, both campaigns knew what the rules were. They knew what they were competing for. Any complaints about the rules that existed prior to or including election day, and even in the counting and auditing process afterwards, is really just sore loserism. And the courts confirmed that after the election. Because for the first time in American history, we had over 60 court cases brought by a losing campaign, the presidential campaign. And every single one of those courts upheld the outcome, found no evidence of widespread fraud or malfeasance that would have changed the outcome, including many judges appointed by a losing presidential candidate himself. So this is something we should feel really good about. Our elections are getting better and better and better each time. Over the last 20 years, we've seen an unprecedented development of professionalism in the election administration area from, 2000 when Florida was an international laughing stock to, for instance, in 2020 when Florida was actually an international model because of the hard work of the men and women who run elections from the state, county, and even down to the poll worker level.
The losing presidential candidate in 2020 had the option of requesting recounts.
So in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, state law allows any losing candidate to request a full statewide recount of the ballots. If you recall, in 2016, Jill Stein, who hadn't even finished second in those states, did request a recount. Now you have to pay for them, and it costs a few million dollars to do that. But remember, President Trump had raised, by all accounts, roughly $200 million in just the weeks after the election. Recent reports suggest it was more like $500 million in the couple of years since then.
That's
so
shocking.
He had the money. He could have gone in and said to Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, you're going to recount all of your ballots, by the way, all of which are paper in all three of those states. That wasn't the case in 2016, at least in Pennsylvania. And he chose not to. which I think speaks volumes about his state of mind, about whether he really thought he had lost the election or won the election. We have to remember this election was the widest margin of any presidential election in the 21st century when Barack Obama was on the ballot.
And when you request a recount, something comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
The ethical responsibility to accept the results of the recount.
Right. And I feel that someone must have explained that to him, to the president.
And that requested, and that has got to be remembered as part of this history. He had every right on behalf of his aggrieved supporters to find out via a recount. He had the financial wherewithal by several orders of magnitude.
Correct.
With that request would have come the requirement, the transparent requirement, to accept the results.
And he has never been known to be a person who backs down on anything, right?
Right.
He pushes everything to the nth degree, even in all of his law cases.
When we saw those who still harbor doubts, I asked them, hey, why not this? Come on. It was the most practical, legal, justifiable request that could have been made, and it never came.
And we have to remember also, and it's a point we make in the book, that these paper ballots didn't just have a presidential race on them. They had other statewide races. They had every congressional seat was up in 2020.
Exactly.
A third of the Senate was up in 2020. Most of the state legislature seats were up in 2020. And many of the same people in Congress and in state legislatures who are raising false claims about the 2020 election have no problem with the fact the reason they have the authority to raise those false claims is because they were elected on those exact same paper ballots. Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, wherever you look, that was the case. This is, it's a massive fraud, unfortunately, really being targeted at the sincerely disappointed supporters of the former president, who understandably are unhappy with the outcome. Who among us has not experienced an electoral disappointment in the last decade? We all understand that that's part of democracy, elections mm-hmm. are winners and losers. But to see the people who supported the former president be targeted for this long grift is particularly disappointing. It saddens me.
And that's why we have a heart. And in the book, we sympathize with them. We really do. We say in the book, there are millions of people in this country who want to support the country, believe in democracy, want to do the right thing. But they also trust the former president more than a lot of other institutions, more than someone like me. I can't that, but I can be sympathetic to it because in this case, and I'm not asking people who are Trump supporters to embrace the Biden agenda. I would never do that.
Me neither. No.
Part of your right in a democracy is disagree with the agenda you disagree with. Fine. Take all that passion. Just don't direct it in this misdirected area because it will harm the country. The country you profess to love. And it will slander something that we used to celebrate in this country.
Right.
You know what I mean by that? We used to celebrate hard tasks done without a roadmap in which collaboration, innovation, and cooperation were required. When I was mm-hmm. a kid, those were all bedrock American values.
Absolutely.
Absolutely embraced and thought were unique. They're not unique to America, but we do it a lot. And we do it so frequently. You sort of think that's one of our natural innate qualities. We did
right.
that in 2020. For goodness sake, let's just celebrate that and move on.
Yeah.
But it's impossible to do because this, it seems to me, and tell me whether you agree or not, or disagree, I'm happy, because it's America. We can do both. The lie continues on. We have people who are running now for the midterm elections who desperately want to be approved by the king. Or let's just be like more fair about it. They desperately want to be approved by Donald Trump. They want his seal of approval so that they will say everything is a fraud, elections are fraudulent, and they're just helping to promulgate it. And I don't know how we move beyond it. That's the part where I sit there and go, you know, social media is magnificent at telling lies and furthering them with people much more than truths, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it's really remarkable how much the lies relate solely to the outcome of the election. They're really completely untethered from the reality of the process, where you see election officials being targeted, not just in the states I mentioned, the close swing states, Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, but also in Florida, Texas, California. Mm-hmm. states that weren't close. Utah, yeah. I mean, these are
right. Utah.
Oh,
this is this sickness is afflicting the entire country, and it's, you know, we do talk about some possible solutions. One that I think is one is going to be political. I mean, if the American people choose to reject this, we need two rational political parties arguing in the arena of policy, but both tethered to reality.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure we have that right now. And we'll see if there's a political solution to this, but there's other solutions. And one of the things we're seeing right now is it does appear that there's finally going to be accountability for some of the people that have led the criminal efforts, the efforts that should incur civil liability, defamation lawsuits being filed against media channels and Mike Lindell. Of course, criminal investigations going on in the Department of Justice in Fulton County, Georgia, a civil investigation happening in New York. These are the kinds of things that I think are incredibly important because we need to change the incentive structure. The incentive structure right now incentivizes the grifters. There are a lot of people getting rich off of the sincere disappointment of a lot more people by lying to them. And we need to change that incentive structure if those people are held accountable for that ongoing fraud.
And look, I've been covering politics since 1990 at a national level. Look, there are a lot of temptations in politics. There are a lot of power. But until the last election in 2020, I never saw a lure to power that would stomp on the very idea of what a democracy is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lure to power now. If you want to be an endorsed primary candidate in a Republican crowded field, the quickest way to be that endorsed candidate from former President Trump is to deny the election, whether you believe it or not. You have to do it. It's become a tactic. It's not a sustainable tactic in this country, period, full stop.
Yeah, if we get to the point in our country where people, maybe even on across the political spectrum, start believing that any election in which their side doesn't win is stolen, our democracy is doomed. You can't have a democracy where the losers can't accept defeat. Especially when the reality right now is more than ever before, we can confirm the outcome of elections. It's really, everything is transparent. The problem election officials have always had is people don't come to the boring nuts and bolts, pre-election testing, post-election audits, all of the things that can be watched over and over and over again. And hopefully, you know, people will learn about these things, maybe volunteer to be poll workers, which is really important. You get to see this from the inside and then and see how many checks and balances there are. There's a reason people show up 2 hours, who work in polls, show up 2 hours before the election and then stay for 3 or 4 hours after the elections because they have to check a lot of boxes and do it in front of poll watchers and others completely transparently.
It'd be interesting just to talk to your point, Major, about you've been watching elections back till 1990. And there's this allure that we say now, right? An allure now to embrace denialism. This kind of grift that was, you know, raised by Donald Trump he didn't invent it, right? So where did it come from? Was there a weak spot that you saw? Where did this come from? How was this possible?
There were others in previous elections who raised doubts about the validity of elections. There have been partisans who have done that. And we've had close elections in our country before. And in our book, we briefly summarize the very closest presidential elections and some of the underlying contentions, 1800, 1824, 1876, 1960, 2000 are the best examples. And what distinguishes all of them from 2020 is those who are at the top of the ticket, either president or nominee, never, ever said a thing that would suggest they did not believe that the ultimate process would prevail and the process itself to determine the winner should be respected and was legitimate. That's only happened once in our history. Everything before it is different than what we experienced in 2020. Former President Trump is singular and alone in his debasement of the fundamentals of American democracy and the processes by which we gather the will of the people and render that verdict and proclaim a victor of an election. No one has done what he has done. So he is by himself. So I can't say that there were people like him that he just amplified ever so slightly. And history will so judge him for that. Now, Did people raise objections, for example, in the very close election for the presidency in 1960? Yes, there were many Republicans, partisans who urged Richard Nixon, then the vice president,
right,
challenge that election in court. And in certain jurisdictions, grand juries were impaneled to investigate allegations of improprieties. But Richard Nixon did not. Not only did he not, he famously in 1961, and there's great video of this, clips of this, presided over the electoral victory of John F. Kennedy as the sitting vice president. Al Gore did the same thing in 2001 after a very close election in 2020 in Florida, 537 votes. And as we, I believe, helpfully point out in the book, there were four other states not named Florida in the 2000 presidential campaign that had closer margins of victory than any of the states described as super close in the 2020 election. 2000 was a much closer election in far more jurisdictions and states than the 2020 election. And Al Gore not only accepted the results, though he was unhappy with them, he gave probably, and many regard this, I'm not an expert on this, but I've watched a lot of speeches, the best speech of his life in conceding. And he presided over what? The certification of electoral vote as the sitting vice president in 2001. So, yes, there have been those who have objected to previous elections. There has been contention. There's a small library devoted to the election of 1876, deservedly so, because that was an incredibly important election.
Right.
Close, its resolution echoes through American history because it had to do with Reconstruction and a lot of other things. But no one has been where former President Trump has put himself and put millions of Americans. And that's one of the reasons we wrote the book, to say this is a distinct moment, singular in the peril it presents for this magnificent, beautiful American experiment.
And if I just underline a point, and if you look at 2000, really close election, one state deciding the Electoral College, and that state decided by 537 votes, with a system that actually did have some flaws that we have fixed, the punch card ballots, the butterfly ballots, things like that. That doesn't happen anymore. We passed the Help America Vote Act shortly after that. It's part of the professionalism I was talking about. Mm-hmm. But both sides' campaigns armed themselves with the best lawyers. I work really closely with Ben Ginsburg, who led the Florida effort for President Bush. And they exhausted their remedies under the rule of law. And I was working at the Department of Justice at the time as a voting rights attorney. We were told the Department of Justice, we stay out of this. We don't talk about it. We don't do anything that is a campaign matter and a campaign matter only. The federal government, the power of the DOJ is not going to get involved here. The campaigns were well represented. And then once the Supreme Court ruled in mid-December, Vice President Gore did not like the ruling of the Supreme Court. Many people didn't. And in fact, the Supreme Court kind of unusually said, this is going to be a unique ruling. This can't be cited again. And it was a 5-4 decision.
One time only.
Yeah. Very unusual. Lots of reasons to dislike it. But Vice President Gore accepted the institution of the Supreme Court, accepted the rule of law, and upheld it, again, as Major said, with an incredible speech after that, and then presided over his own defeat in the joint session. That is something, along with what Vice President Nixon did in 1960 and 61, that's the best of American democratic traditions, accepting the rule of law. What we've seen from the losing presidential candidate in 2020 is utter and complete contempt for the rule of law. And once the rule of law is exhausted, he certainly had his opportunity with over 60 cases. And once his process was exhausted, he had the opportunity to request recounts, et cetera. He then said, that's not the end of this. I'm going to take it to the next level. And the next level, unfortunately, was essentially inciting violence.
Let's remember that that man also didn't show up at the inauguration of Joe Biden either. There was no touch of the cap to the transfer of power at all, which I suppose, considering everything you've just said, shouldn't have surprised any of us. A question about the future. Let's say the Republicans win big in the midterm. It doesn't have to happen, Elaine. Don't worry. If the Republicans win big in 2022, could it have a possible positive impact on denialists?
Well, if not every Republican who is running is a full-blown denialist. Some are. There are candidates in Pennsylvania and Arizona and Michigan who are four-square denialists. There are those who play footsie with it. There are those who are running who don't really wade into these waters and try to focus their campaign energy on inflation, immigration, crime, which are standard garden variety and completely legitimate midterm elections. But to your point, if those who embrace denialism use it in the primary, repeat it, and brandish it in the general election win, that's a very bad thing.
Yeah, and
there's just no other way to describe it, because that tactic in a primary will have then proved successful in a general election, and then the incentive structure will deepen. And my hope is that voters will weigh a lot of issues in a midterm election, but will draw a line at election denialism and say, no, that is by definition disqualifying. Because if you don't support the democratic experiment, how can I rely on you for other things that I would depend upon you on as my representative, either as governor or secretary of state or a member of Congress or a member of the United States Senate?
Yeah, and I think one of the things we try hard to do is not to turn this into a partisan Democratic versus Republican thing. Many of the people we highlight in the book, some of the most courageous people in the last 2 years have been Republicans who have been willing to speak truth to their own voters, to their own leaders. People like Senator Ed McGrew in Michigan, people like Al Schmidt in Philadelphia, people like Brad Raffensperger and Gabe Sterling in Georgia, people like the entire Maricopa County Board of Supervisors.
Right.
People who stood up for the truth and have paid a political price. Liz Cheney perhaps being most famous in that. So I try to stay away from the predictions. I don't know what's going to happen politically, but I do know that we're in a perilous situation no matter what. Mm-hmm. Because either it's a possibility that election deniers get elected and govern as if it's their job, as if it's a feature of their governance to put their thumb on the scale for themselves and other candidates like themselves, mm-hmm. rather than facilitate true democracy, or they lose. And it might not matter how close the margins are, and they incite political violence, which is something that keeps me up at night.
Now, let's just play this out. There's a candidate running for governor in Arizona. Her name is Carrie Lake. If she were to challenge the election results, she would have some uncomfortable history to have to deal with.
Yes.
Uncomfortable history. Well, in the primary, she made allegations loosely that this was a fraudulent system. When the votes were being counted, she raised suspicions about the counting of the votes because she was behind. And then when she went ahead, suddenly all of those suspicions and doubts evaporated. And when she was declared the winner, she accepted the result in total. Well, that's a process by which you doubted until you prevailed. Well, the exact same system will be used in the general election. More voters will be involved, but it's the exact same system. So suddenly she starts raising doubts of a close outcome. There will be those lawyers, journalists, and constituents in the state of Arizona who will say, wait a minute, we've watched this movie before. This legitimacy of your argument seems only vectored through your victory or defeat. That can't be the basis of a legitimate election challenge. And one of the things we also talk about in the book, and one of the things I'm very glad that David is my partner on this because he knows this world so well. Every campaign will have an advocate. Mm-hmm. And the courts are open and the courts are prepared. And the courts were trained in 2020 to gear up for this kind of litigation.
That's a good point.
Courts will be there. And advocates for campaigns will not allow an election to be stolen from them in broad daylight.
Well, and we have to remember also, whether it was pre-2020 or pre-2022, the rules, like them or not, are set. We know what they are. They're public. They could have done something to challenge those ahead of time, and they either didn't or they lost. And this is the way campaigns have always been run. Campaigns are always trying to game the rules. And if they fail, they have to accept that. The fact is we had more pre-election litigation than ever before in 2020. And in fact, Republicans won the vast majority. 7 out of every 8 cases was won by Republicans in advance. Democrats didn't like some of the rules. In Ohio, famously, and Texas, boxes were limited to 1 per county. In some counties like Harris County, Texas, which is the 3rd largest county in the country, that's ridiculous. But that's what the courts ruled. Then you have to accept that. And it's we cannot live in a country where, again, as Major said, the only definition of a secure election is whether or not your chosen candidate won.
And a word about drop boxes for a second. So on social media now, you can find conversations about tailgates and vigils around drop boxes. I speak just as a matter of logic, right? Drop boxes are already secure. Most of them are video surveilled, but they're all secure in the sense that ballots that go in there go one place and one place only, straight to the place where they will be processed and counted. Straight from there, the secure locked facility to the county. We vote by mail. Those go in mailboxes. Mailboxes that are distributed all over the place that are not as secure as lock boxes. And guess what? That mail is mixed up with what? Other mail. And where does it go? In trucks or vans, it is transported to a facility where it's processed. Then it goes to the county facility. There are two or three other steps in the mailbox process that are not involved in the drop box process. So the drop box is by logic, by basic human understanding, are better than mailboxes. And we don't see social media campaigns to have tailgates and vigils around mailboxes. But I believe over time, and this is a matter where time and the continuance of logic and the continuance of facts, I do believe can and will prevail. Because time doesn't heal all wounds, but time and the stability, and I would say the counter stubbornness of truth, that's why we put it in the title, matters. It is not moving, because it is immovable. These truths are not debatable at their essence. They are not, and they are going to stay. They're going to stay. And they will outlast, I hope and believe, ultimately, that's the sort of optimistic end of the book, they will outlast this spasm, this psychic spasm of denialism.
We have to wrap up now, but I feel terrible about what's happening, especially, I think the point of that Republican poll workers are getting attacked more, you know, because it's harder for them, you know, how could you be a Republican and not be understanding that there's some terrible fraud going on? The idea that they're being doxxed and threatened. I mean, I watched a poll worker on the news yesterday burst into tears or try and hold back tears describing her plight. But the point that we started with and the point that I want to wrap up with, because I want people to have some hope, is the immense number of people who ensure our elections are safe. And from the lowest level, from teeny tiny county in teeny tiny corner of Tennessee to my big old county here in New Jersey.
So that's exactly right. And one of the things I really worry about, and this is something that both sides, maybe not equally, but it can affect both sides, is the distrust of the other side. There are forces that want us to distrust each other, that want us to refuse to see each other as fellow citizens, but rather as enemies occupying the same land. That's very dangerous. That, you know, foreign adversaries like China and Russia and others have tried to destroy American democracy from within for decades, and they failed. And right now, domestic actors are succeeding in ways. So don't regard, whatever your political philosophy is, don't look at others from the other philosophy as enemies. Don't distrust election officials of the other party. If you're a Democrat that happens to live in a red county, or if you're a Republican who happens to live in a blue county, those people are doing their jobs very well. And if you want to see it for yourself, volunteer to be a poll worker and see it from the inside. But don't fall victim to the division and the distrust that the grifters are trying to impose upon you. We've been through two genuinely traumatic moments in American history, not just two, but two that linger in our collective history. Obviously, the Civil War is one that for 20 years before the Civil War, there was an effort to politically resolve and compromise away the expansion of our country into other states and territories without or with slavery. And it was uncompromisable because the underlying issue was so severe. The underlying defect of our country structurally could not be resolved any other way. It was a structural defect in the country that had to be resolved through one way and one way only, the bullet and the bayonet.
And we fought a civil war for 4 years to resolve that. The next one is one I remember as a child. The deep disagreements in this country over Vietnam and the Vietnam War, and what that war represented, what that war was said to be about, what it was actually about, and the cost inflicted on this country, generationally, politically, and in terms of its own identity. I would say those are the two greatest epochs of division in this country. This is something comparable to those three, but here's the good news. Here's the good news. The Civil War was about a structural defect that could not be resolved any other way. We tried. History tells us it could not be resolved any other way. Vietnam War was a war fought originally for Cold War purposes to protect the country, but ultimately its methods of execution and the underlying rationale for it could not withstand the scrutiny of the public. And thousands of Americans died and protested, and it nearly pulled the country apart. That was a war we fought in a foreign land. The psychic spasm we're here experiencing now is about something that actually isn't a problem. It's not a structural defect of the country, and it's not a war we're fighting. It is a set of beliefs we're choosing to indulge in. It is an indulgence, and it's a dangerous one, but it is only that. It is not nearly as difficult to resolve or to come to grips with as the Civil War or the Vietnam War or the antecedents before either. The good news is we have things that work, provable things that work before our very eyes. All we have to do is work through a sense of tolerance, forbearance, and get back more closely to the things that has always made America strong. We don't have to weaken ourselves to make this better. We only have to get back to our original strong selves. It's not that far a journey. It will take some time, but it's much closer and much more easily resolved than those very deep divisions and structural problems that led to the Civil War and the deep divisions in this country over Vietnam. We can do this.
I think that is why your book resonated with me so much, because it is so truly hopeful and important to have that understanding of our history and the understanding of the safety and of our electoral system, our election process, which I think, David, also you make an incredibly strong point and an important reminder of how that is. I thank you too very, very much. I hope everybody will read this book, The Big Truth, because it is important for us to focus on the truth instead of the lies. Here goes the rye. And I hope to have you guys on for another episode, because we need to talk about the history of Angostura bitters, which is fascinating.
Thank you so much for listening. You can find Major and David's book, The Big Truth, wherever fine books are sold. And you can follow them both on Twitter. I will see you all also on Twitter and hopefully on Substack too at marissarodkopf.substack.com. Have a great week.